Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, January 18, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the five major updates at the National Labor Relations Board. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will likely be transcribed. We're very pleased to welcome an expert today who's going to give us some opening remarks, sort of giving us background on these five recent updates, recent developments. He is a repeat guest on Teleform, John Rodabaugh, who's a staff attorney at the National Right to Work Foundation. He's a former member of the National Labor Relations Board we'll be discussing today. He's also the Reed Larson Professor of Labor Law at the Ave Maria School of Law in Naples, Florida, where he's coming to us today. With that, Professor Rodabaugh, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. I will thank you for this opportunity. We'll be reviewing five major case decisions issued during the week of December 11, 2017, the last week of former NLRB Chairman Ms. O'Meara's chairmanship at the board. Number one, UMPC Presbyterian Hospital issued on December 11, the board in a 3-2 party line vote overruled an Obama board decision, U.S. Postal Service, issued in 2016, returning to prior precedent of a 1987 decision in Independent Stave, permitting administrative law judges to accept a respondent's proposed settlement terms over the objection of the general counsel and charging party, provided the proposed terms are deemed reasonable. The 2016 Obama board majority had rejected Independent Stave because it was formulated to evaluate non-board settlement agreements between a respondent and a charging party to which the general counsel was not a party and objected to by the general counsel and charging party for failing to provide a full remedy. By returning to Independent Stave, administrative law judges' decisions shall again have the authority administrative law judges shall again have the authority to accept settlements over the general counsel's or parties' objections, considering whether the parties to the dispute and the employees affected have agreed to the settlement, whether the settlement was the product of a grievance arbitration mechanism, and whether the agreement was entered into voluntarily by the parties without fraud or coercion. As the board noted, encouraging the parties' mutually agreeable settlement without litigation is in the public interest and acknowledges the risks of litigation, significant delay in conclusion, and expenditure of board resources. As an aside, it's interesting to note that the same issues presented in U.S. Postal Service by former General Counsel Griffin were raised by former General Counsel Collier, a Republican, but unanimously rejected by the five-member board and Independent Stave. The dissenters argue that by not finding single employer status, the employer's offer to serve as a guarantor of any remedies was not an effective remedy and frustrates the General Counsel's ability to litigate respondent status as a single employer. The next case, issued on December 14, involving the Boeing Company, the Republican board majority overruled Lutheran Heritage Village Livonia of 2004, rejecting the Lutheran Heritage standard for evaluating facially neutral employer work rules, policies, and employee handbook provisions. Under that standard, the board had found unlawful rules that do not explicitly prohibit protected activities, were not adopted in response to such activities, and were not applied to restrict such activities if the rules as, quote, reasonably construed, end of quote, and my favorite, would reasonably tend to chill employees in the exercise of their Section 7 rights to form, join, or assist labor organizations, to bargain collectively, to engage in other concerted activities for mutual aid or protection, or to refrain from any such activities. Under the board's new test for evaluating whether a facially neutral policy, rule, or handbook provision would, when reasonably interpreted, potentially interfere with the exercise of Section 7 rights, will now consider One, the nature and extent of the potential impact on National Labor Relations Act rights, and two, the employer's legitimate justifications for the rule. Going forward, challenge rules will now be evaluated and categorized to provide greater clarity and certainty to employees, employers, and labor organizations. Category 1 will be rules designated as lawful because the rule, when, quote, reasonably interpreted, does not prohibit or interfere with the exercise of statutory rights or any potential adverse impact is outweighed by justifications for the rule. Category 1 would include rules that, when reasonably interpreted, would have no tendency to interfere with Section 7 rights, and rules that, although they had a reasonable tendency to interfere with such rights, the board has determined that the risk of such interference is outweighed by the employer's justifications. Category 2 will include rules warranting individualized scrutiny in each case, and Category 3 will be rules designated as unlawful because they prohibit or limit protected conduct and such adverse impact is not outweighed by justifications associated with the rule. Finally, under the new approach, even if a rule is deemed lawful, the board will examine whether the rule is applied to discipline employees who engaged in protected activity, in which case the discipline may be found to violate the act. In dissent, Member Pierce notes that the Lutheran Heritage Standard, now rejected, had been upheld by every court reviewing the matter, the D.C. Circuit, 1st, 2nd, 5th, and 11th, and in agreement with Member McFerrin, criticized the board majority for not notifying the public and soliciting views regarding a reversal of precedent, to which the majority, and this was a common dissent during that week, of not giving public notice and inviting public view, and in many of the cases, the majority responded essentially, well, you didn't do that either in some of the major decisions during the Obama era. Well, our next case is very, very notable, Hybrand Industrial Contractors Limited. This involves the board's controversial 2015 decision in Browning Ferris Industries, addressing joint employer liability, and it was overruled in this Hybrand decision on December 14. In their majority opinion, they reasoned that, first, the Browning Ferris test exceeded the board's statutory authority by leveraging theories of economic realities and statutory purpose far beyond common law limits of direct and immediate control over another employer's employees' essential terms and conditions of employment. Also, number two, the Browning Ferris majority rationale relied in part on the notion that the modern economy presents conditions radically different from early years when labor negotiations were unaffected by the direct employer's commercial dealings, which, in the majority opinion in the current Hybrand case, they rejected given the existence of third-party business relationships having existed for centuries. The third reason, courts afford the board deference merely as to drawing factual distinctions when applying the common law agency standard, but not as a grant of authority to modify the agency standard itself. According to the Hybrand majority, the evidence of indirect control or contractually reserved authority is probative only to the extent that it supplements evidence of direct control. The fourth rationale, Browning Ferris replaced a long-standing test providing certainty and predictability with a vague and ill-defined standard imposing bargaining obligations on multiple entities based on never exercised indirect control over which a board later decides is an essential element in the employment term threatening to cause substantial instability in bargaining relationships, impose substantial burdens, expense, and liability for innumerable parties. And a fifth reason, the Browning Ferris's majority's goal of correcting a perceived inequality of bargaining leverage resulting from complex bargaining and business relationships involving entities not participating in collective bargaining could only be fixed by a clear congressional command. As they said, dragging third parties into collective bargaining, wherever there is some interdependence, is much more likely to thwart labor peace than advance it. As the Supreme Court has made clear, the board is not vested with general authority to shape national economic policy by balancing competing interests of different business enterprises. Browning Ferris is viewed by the majority as fostering substantial bargaining instability by requiring the non-consensual presence of too many entities with diverse and conflicting interests on the so-called employer side of the table. The high-brand majority returns case law to prior precedent requiring proof that putative joint employer entities have exercised joint control over essential employment terms rather than merely, quote, reserving the right to do so, and control must be direct and immediate, not indirect, and will not result from control that is merely limited and routine. The dissent notes that, quote, the predictability that the majority achieves here is a one-sided assurance to employers by retaining a nominal distance from the supervision of workers. They can exert control and still avoid statutory bargaining obligations. Well, on the day following the Hybrand decision, the NLRB petitioned the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to remand the pending BFI case, which had been argued before the court in March. On December 22, the Circuit Court granted the motion and remanded the case. The union filed a motion for reconsideration on January 4, 2018, arguing the Hybrand decision was defective. Relatedly, on November 7, 2017, the House of Representatives passed H.R. 3442, Save Local Business Act, amending the National Labor Relations Act, Section 2-2, and the Fair Labor Standards Act, Section 3-D, to provide a clear definition of joint employment. To read, a person may be considered a joint employer in relation to an employee only if such person directly, actually, and immediately, and not in a limited and routine manner, exercises significant control over essentials, terms, and conditions of employment, such as hiring employees, discharging employees, determining individual employee rates of pay and benefits, day-to-day supervision of employees, assigning individual work schedules, positions, and tasks, or administering employee discipline. I think notably as well, this decision will result in fewer joint employer findings, and I think the impact of the previous board majority decision under the Obama administration in Miller and Anderson, that will be reduced where they were arguing and found that joint employed employee units combined with solely employed employees by a user employer could be found without the consent of the user employer. So I think this protects employees significantly. The next case, one that has been wished for, I'm sure, by some parties for a long time, was PCC Structural, Inc. This ended the six-year run of Specialty Healthcare and Rehabilitation Center of Mobile, where they found micro units, and this was brought to an end by the new board majority. They reinstated the traditional community of interest standard for determining appropriate bargaining units in representation cases. You may recall Specialty Healthcare permitted a union petition among a group of employees sharing a community of interest under traditional standards, considering whether the employees are organized into a separate department, have distinct skills and training, have distinct job functions and perform distinct work, are functionally integrated with other employees, have frequent contact with other employees, interchange with other employees, have distinct terms and conditions of employment, and are separately supervised. But where the employer contended that the unit must include additional employees excluded from the union's petition for a unit, specialty health care had required the employer to prove that the excluded employees that it's wishing were included share an overwhelming community of interest with the petition for a unit, such that there is no legitimate basis upon which to exclude certain employees from the requested unit. This burden was discarded in PCC structural by the new board majority. The employer argued that the board had effectively abdicated its duty to determine an appropriate unit on a case-by-case basis as required by Section 9B of the statute, that specialty health care gave controlling weight to the extent of union organizing in unit determinations contrary to the Act Section 9C5, that the result of specialty health care is a proliferation of fractured bargaining units, ignoring the shared interests of both the petition for and excluded employees, and that it failed to adequately consider the Section 7 rights of excluded employees. The board majority also reinstated Park Manor Care Center, a 1991 decision, which was standard for determining appropriate bargaining units in non-acute care healthcare facilities. In response, the dissent noted that 8 circuits, the D.C., 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th, had upheld specialty health care, and that in the majority's view, quote, the statutory right of employees to seek union representation as self-defined group is contingent on the imputed desires of employees outside the unit who have expressed no view on representation at all, with the employer serving as their self-appointed proxy. The majority responded, stating that the required assessment of whether the sought-after employees' interests are sufficiently distinct from those of employees excluded from the petition for a group provides some assurance that extent of organizing will not be determinative, as is prohibited by 9C5. It ensures that bargaining units will not be arbitrary, irrational, or fractured, that is, composed of a gerrymandered grouping of employees whose interests are insufficiently distinct from those of other employees to constitute that grouping a separate appropriate unit. And it ensures that Section 7 rights of excluded employees who share a substantial but less than overwhelming community of interest with the sought-after group are taken into consideration. On December 14, one day prior to the issuance of PCC Structural, the board published in the Federal Register a request for information inviting public input as to whether the board's 2014 election rule, frequently referred to as the quickie election rule, should be modified or rescinded, and responses are due no later than February 12 of this year. One week following the board's PCC structural decision, the General Counsel's Division of Operations Management issued Memorandum OM 18-05. Regional directors now have discretion to entertain requests to revisit a unit determination and approve a request to withdraw from an election agreement, considering the extraordinary circumstances brought on by the board's modification of extant law. Of related importance, in a December 20, 2017 unpublished decision, ADT Security Services, Chairman Kaplan and Member Emanuel each noted their interest in revisiting the board's blocking charge policy to generally protect against dismissing an employee's decertification petition on contested and unproven unfair labor practice allegations. Our next case, Raytheon Network Centric Systems. When a change is not an unlawful unilateral change, was restored by the board majority in Raytheon, decided December 15, overruling the DuPont case of 2016, which is currently under review before the D.C. Circuit. Following expiration of a collective bargaining agreement, the employer in that case unilaterally modified employee medical benefits and related costs consistent with past practice. the DuPont majority had held that taking the same actions as done for years and over pursuant and or pursuant to a management rights clause nonetheless constituted a change requiring advance notice to the union and opportunity to bargain if the now expired collective bargaining agreement permitted such past actions. DuPont had also required notice and bargaining in any case in the absence of a current collective agreement where the employer's actions involved discretion. Well, the Raytheon majority rejected DuPont as destabilizing bargaining relationships and ignoring the dynamic status quo, a regular and consistent past pattern of change under NLRB versus Katz, decided by the Supreme Court in 1962. Raytheon holds that regardless of the circumstances under which a past practice developed, that is, whether or not the past practice developed under a collective bargaining agreement containing a management rights clause authorizing unilateral employer action, an employer's past practice constitutes a term and condition of employment that permits the employer to take actions unilaterally that do not materially vary in kind or degree from what has been customary in the past. The majority also emphasized that its decision has no effect on an employer's duty to bargain upon request over any and all mandatory bargaining subjects unless an exception to that duty applies. Member Kaplan, now chairman, noted that the Raytheon plan contained a reservation of rights clause independent of a management rights provision, allowing the employer to modify unit employees' costs and or benefits which would survive until the parties negotiated a new contract. The dissent contends that the employer's discretionary unilateral changes to its health care benefit plans do not constitute a past practice under Katz, as they were not based on any cognizable fixed criteria as to timing and criteria establishing a past practice. The dissent notes that the Supreme Court stated in Katz, when changes are made with a large measure of discretion, there is no way for a union to know whether or not there has been a substantial departure from past practice. Now I'd like to just mention the importance of the new General Counsel Robb's Memorandum 18-02 of December 1, 2017. Where he issues this memorandum identifying 15 topics subject to possible alternative analysis, inviting presentation to the board and submission to advice. One, concerted activity for mutual aid and protection involving only one employee. Two, employer handbook rules previously found unlawful. Three, a review of the previous board majority's purple communications providing employees a presumptive right to use employer email systems to engage in Section 7 activity. Four, finding work stoppages protected in a variety of contexts, notably in retail sales in that QuietFlex manufacturing company case issued in 2005. Next, off-duty employee access to property. Number six, conflicts with other statutory requirements, for example, racist comments and social media posts. Seventh item, a review of Weingarten expanding range of permissible conduct by union representatives in Weingarten interviews and in the drug testing context. Eight, disparate treatment of represented employees during contract negotiations. Nine, the joint employer issue as it applies in other fact patterns. 10, successorship based on the hiring of predecessor employees required by a local statute. Number 11, unilateral changes consistent with past practice. 12, a review of the 2016 Total Security case establishing a duty to bargain before imposing discretionary discipline where the parties have not executed an initial collective bargaining agreement. Number 13, duty to provide witness statements to union. 14, dues checkoff obligations surviving expiration of the collective bargaining agreement. And number 15, remedies involving search for work and interim employment expenses recoverable regardless of whether the discriminatee had interim earnings under King Soopers. The General Counsel's memo also rescinded 7 prior memorandums issued by the previous General Counsels and 5 advice memoranda, notably 1701, finding statutory rights of university faculty and graduate students in the unfair labor practice context, overruling 1603, seeking board reconsideration of the Levitz framework, employer withdrawal of recognition based on objective evidence of loss of majority support, taking back and overruling 1504, requiring reporting of the General Counsel concerning employer rules, 1302, inclusion of front pay in board settlements, 1201, a guideline on collier deferral in arbitration, 1104, regarding default language, and Operations Management 1702, providing a model brief regarding intermittent and partial strikes. So we have a significant amount of activity that occurred in the last calendar week of the former Republican majority at the NLRB and the outgoing general chairman, Phil Mescramero. So with that, I will turn it back, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Let's go right to the floor for questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Rodabaugh, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I don't see any questions yet, so our lines are wide open. Push the star button, then the pound button. Well, we're waiting to see who else might weigh in here. Professor, let me ask you whether or not it's common or how common it is for the board to solicit or allow public notice in decisions like these. There was a call you mentioned, I guess, in one of the dissents that some of these cases deserved going through public notice. NLRB is a bit of an odd animal in the sense that it's not passing regulations. It's sort of regulating through decision-making. So I wonder if you could address
that. Well, you're exactly correct. And I think historically in the past, I mean literally in the past, there was more of a custom and practice of inviting and notifying the public of significant decisions pending and inviting briefing. As you noted, rulemaking has been rarely conducted. But in public, in pending board cases, on major possible reversals of significant precedent, there would be an invitation. And in fact, going back even to my term in the early 90s, on significant situations like that, we would even schedule oral argument before the board. That practice has not been used in many years, and I think the comments of the former board chairman and his Democrat colleague currently on the board in objecting rather loudly in these last few 5-member decisions contradicted themselves, because there were significant decisions during the Obama period where they had not notified the public or invited briefing.
Yeah, that's interesting to me. Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. You mentioned that these decisions, these latest 5 decisions that we're talking about today, overruled some earlier decisions. And I'm just curious, you don't have to go case by case, but just curious if those decisions that were being overruled, if in the process of those decisions being made, there was the public notice, public comment. One of them you mentioned, I think, was from 2016. So it sounds like if this was a distant practice, that didn't happen. But one of them you mentioned was 2004. So were the cases they were overruling subject to the public notice and public comment?
No, I don't believe so. There was an interesting publication by the U.S. Chamber last year where they analyzed, I think it was by Ogletree Deacons, where they did a significant study on looking at the significant overruling of years and years of precedent by the Obama board. I think we're at the stage where I personally think it reflects badly to overturn significant precedent without inviting public notice and informing the public indirectly that, you know, this issue is up for reconsideration. But again, the NLRB is an independent agency and does things its own way.
Were these decisions a surprise to anyone, or were they anticipated? And if they were anticipated, could people just write letters to the editor or otherwise informally comment on the anticipated decisions, or is that not quite good enough?
Well, I think that these decisions were highly anticipated simply because they reflect decisions by the Obama board that really upset conditions, years and years of precedent, and challenged and I think infringed on, most importantly in my view, employee rights to make informed decisions and be free to choose whether or not they wish to be represented by a third party. I think what currently happened was simply that the outgoing five-member board chairman, Mr. Miskramara, once he left, it reduced the board down to a 2-2 split, and until the current nominee is confirmed by the Senate, you know, there's no way to really overturn significant precedent, because the custom at the board is to require a full five-member board to do so. So I think these were very anticipated. Why? Because what the Republican board did during that week of December 11 was overturn decisions by the Obama board that had overturned years of precedent. So
right.
These were highly, highly debated, highly anticipated. I don't think people were surprised.
Interesting. That sort of, in my mind at least, undermines the idea that you have to have public comment. If these were highly anticipated, people could have found their way, I suppose. But we do have a question from the audience now, so let's take our first question of the day. And by the way, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Go right ahead, caller.
Yes, this is Jerry Hunter from St. Louis. Former member and Professor Rollerby, I think you did an excellent job on the summary. My question to you is, do you think the case pending in the D.C. Circuit, even though the union is opposing the general counsel request that the case be remanded to the board, do you have any concerns that the D.C. Circuit will deny the NLRB general counsel's request to remand the case? And in situations where there are other cases pending in circuits where the board has reversed many cases, do you think the NLRB general counsel will also move file motions with those circuits asking that those cases be remanded to the board for further consideration?
Well, first of all, Jerry, it's wonderful to hear your voice. glad we're talking.
Yeah.
Miss those days. First of all, going to your last question, I think the general counsel will similarly notify any other circuit courts where similar cases involving that issue are pending. They will take the same approach. I'm not good at predicting. I'm not certain why the D.C. Circuit wouldn't agree to ignore the most recent filing by the union and stick with its prior decision to remand the case, given the new decision. So I would like to think that the challenge to that question is over.
Well, I hope you're right, and you are correct that on the obviously, I'm sure all the listeners will know you're correct that the many decisions issued by the Pierce board and the previous chairman, I know Balmer, they were not all those boards did not give notice and permit briefing in all the cases. In some cases, they did permit briefing, but they did not do that in any number of cases where they overrule longstanding precedent.
Right.
Let me make a final call for questions. We've got some time left. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Now's the time. Okay, I think we've had our final question, Professor Rodabaugh. Let me give you a minute or two to wrap up if you have a final thought you want to express.
Well, as I have mentioned to my students in labor law class, I love the inscription on the National Archives building, "What is past is prologue." The board, unfortunately, in my opinion, has developed over time what has been derogatorily referred to as flip-flopping. One could have some humor in suggesting, is it the National Labor Resuscitation Board, or is it the National Labor Repression Board, or are we going to return to what is fair and balanced, neutral, the National Labor Relations Board? I think we've had now decades of the flip-flopping, and perhaps someday Congress will reconsider how we should possibly handle labor-related issues in judging now from 83 years of experience under a 1935 act. I think it's time to bring more stability to board decisions and not have it so correlated with the party and the majority of the five-member board and or the general counsel's office. But again, I want to thank you, Dean, for this opportunity and wish everyone well.
Well, thank you, Professor Rodabaugh, on my own behalf, but also on behalf of the Federal Society and on behalf of our callers. I want to thank our callers as well for dialing in and for participating. Reminder to check the Federal Society's website, monitor your emails for notices about upcoming scheduled telephone conference calls. I know we've got at least one or two tomorrow, so do check in. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.